I'm going to read you a poem, a most beautiful poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. Really, we could live with that. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains, the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild birds high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild birds, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. So somehow, in this quite wondrous poem, Mary Oliver has captured so many of our needs and our longings, and very particularly, I think, our longings for love and our longings for a sense of belonging. What most disrupts our peace of mind is anxiety about our place in things and our anxieties about coping with those disruptions to our place in things, and also and very specifically and in 10,000 ways, what also disrupts our peace is our fear of loving enough. If we were to love life with all the capacities of our heart and soul, we would not need even to be thinking about what peace is or who we are. Love would be teaching us. But somewhere in the conditioning that our minds have received since we came into this body, into this life, there has been a kind of slippage. We come in knowing what love is, not in utter nakedness and not in entire forgetfulness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home. We haven't forgotten. We are not entirely naked. We are already clothed in beauty, but forgetting happens. Slippage happens. Slippage between our sense of self and the other, but also slippage between our sense of self and ourselves. In other words, we build up a picture of ourselves that is not founded in compassion, in wonder, in awe, in humility, in ecstasy, in bliss. We take on the cloak of timidity. We all do. We all do. And spirituality, when it is radical enough, calls on us to be braver than that. To be bolder than that. To be much more passionate than that. And any teaching that comes that is cloaked in a kind of version of contraction of life is really to be looked at very closely. Because it seems to me that the one glorious thing that the wisdom teachings have in common, no matter from which period they come, no matter from which corner of the earth they come, no matter through which teacher they were espoused or articulated, they all invite us into the bigness, the gloriousness of existence. So that while we are here for this brief moment on this earth, we can not only give love, honor, and delight, and also compassion and consolation for the griefs and sorrows that are also part of existence. But we can also receive those qualities. And I think that some of the slippage that I was referring to comes because we also forget how to receive. We forget what we can really depend upon, and in its place we put hollow gods. Yeah. We forget what we can depend upon because sometimes the versions of it seem so shaky, seem so unreliable. Now, I want to tell you that when I come up with a theme for the retreats each time, usually twice a year, one of the reasons we are rather a large retreat family this time is because I didn't give the Easter retreat this year for the very first time. I took a sabbatical. But usually there are two retreats here at Mana each year. And sometimes Donna says, well, what's the theme? We need to announce it. And I try to be very quick, just allowing this to arise so that I'm not processing it too much. I'm allowing myself to be given the theme for the retreat. But then, of course, I spend a very long time, many, many months, dwelling with it. So when this theme first came, making peace with yourself, I thought, well, that's rather good. I need that. I definitely do, and I hope you do too. But I really thought I would be teaching quite a lot on forgiveness. And I haven't taught much on forgiveness for quite a few years. I've hop, skipped and jumped around forgiveness, or I've answered your questions around forgiveness. But of course it's a really profound theme, and I've been working on it for 20 years in a very explicit way. So I thought, oh, well, that's good. Done quite a lot of work on that. But no, that wasn't the call. Most interesting to me, and I hope most appropriately to you, the umbrella qualities that seemed to me most needed at this time in our individual consciousness, and even more in our collective consciousness, to which each of us is constantly contributing as well as drawing. Yeah? We're all very powerful here. We are contributing to the collective consciousness and unconsciousness, and we are drawing from it. So the two umbrella qualities that I felt were deeply, hungrily, yearningly called for are compassion and wisdom. And then I thought a great deal about the relationship of wisdom to compassion. That wisdom is something that we grow into and that we allow ourselves to grow into, that we must give ourselves active permission to grow into, and I'll talk much more about this, but not least through embracing all of who we are and all of our experiences. In other words, not going through those kind of petty dualistic judgments of welcoming this and shunning that, but rather stepping up and saying, from whatever it is, but particularly from the unwelcome, okay, what am I ready to know here? What do I need to know here? Yeah? That is how we grow in wisdom. We support our growing in wisdom through our spiritual practices, through our openness of mind, through our doubting, through our questioning, through our receiving, through our prayers, through our perceptions, through questioning our perceptions, through growing in understanding. And we put into practice what we are growing into and growing through and growing with. We put into practice through our embracing, embodying of compassion. You know, on the Sufi, I haven't brought my stole with me this time. I don't know why. But those of you who will know the Sufi wings, the Sufi is the mystical form of Islam, but it actually predates Islam, as all the mystical forms predate all forms. They are formless and full of form that dissolves into formlessness. But the two wings of the Sufi heart are wisdom and compassion. We can't grow in one without receiving and expressing the other. We can't grow more compassionate without growing wiser, and we can't grow wiser without growing more compassionate. And equally, and this is also very healing, we cannot grow more compassionate or wiser in our understanding of others and of the world in which we live without growing more compassionate and wiser in relationship to ourselves. When Mary Oliver says, you do not have to be good, what she means, I think, is that You do not have to be anything other than you are. At the very same time as you grow into wisdom, as you grow into compassion, you will embrace all that you are, and you will shed any need to be less than you are in a very natural and not shunning or punitive or shamed way. You will simply grow out of it. I'm going to be talking after your reflection break about some of the things that the mind does. But the mind does many things, and one of the things that it does is to pause compassion, to judge compassion, to tease it out in ways that are not always helpful. So, for example, your mind may throw up the barrier of the shadow of compassion, which is pity. And in relation to yourself, it might throw up the shadow of self-pity, which is often a very tempting state of mind. And if it arises, or can I say when it arises, rather than again shunning it, we can simply ask it to reveal itself in its stronger state, which is compassion, and allow the pity, which is a kind of weakening of ourselves, just to have a little rest. So compassion is itself strengthening because it reminds us what we are capable, not just of giving and receiving, but of being. We are capable of compassion. So how would that look in everyday life? How it looks could be a bit like this, and there'll be many other things that occur to you. It's about being friendly. It's about being less judgmental. It's about being kinder. It's about being significantly less reactive and less driven by the reactive mind, which most of us have trained like a racehorse that has to win. So we privilege our reactions over other people's, don't we? We excuse our reactiveness and we judge other people. We all do it. We express compassion through our respect. And very particularly through our respectful listening. And we will be practicing that a number of times on this retreat. For many people, one of the greatest gifts that they take away is their enhanced capacity to listen. To listen not just to the kind of trivia that, you know, passes for communication and drains us so much of the time, but actually to listen to what is going on within our own hearts and minds, as well as to one another. When you listen in small groups, I'm going to be quite strong in my instructions to you that you will actually do nothing but listen and receive when you are in your small groups. It's a discipline. And part of spiritual practice is always a commitment to discipline. It's how we grow, not just in self-mastery, but also in wisdom. We quieten the habits that could do with some refinement, and we listen. We listen not to solve, not to give advice, not to top the other person's story, not to remind them of the time when. We listen to receive. So listening is an act of compassion, and being listened to is also an act of compassion. Why? Because it is allowing your feeling state to become part of my feeling state. In other words, it is the spiritual expression of empathy. It doesn't mean I have to take on all your sorrow. I have to take on your shame. I have to take on your addiction. I have to take on your grief. No, it doesn't mean that. But it means I am allowing myself to perceive how this is for you without wrapping it up somehow or blanketing it in my contempt or my pity. I'm allowing myself to be with you as an expression not just of compassion, but of the fundamental truth of our spiritual existence, which is that we belong to one another. If you think about all the sorrows in our world, all the violences in our world, all the assertions of ego and of tribalism and of loathing and of prejudice and of disdain and of war, all the horrors of every age, including our own. We could say, in a way that is very simple and I think very true, that they arise through a total absence of awareness that we belong to one another, and that my happiness entirely depends upon how I treat you and how you treat me. You know, the Buddha said it so beautifully. All the happiness the world contains comes from wishing joy to others. All the sorrow the world contains comes from wishing happiness only for oneself. But of course, happiness there may mean power, conquering, territory, being right, self-righteousness, all sorts of things that impose upon another person, that insist to others that this is the way, that divide and apparently conquer, but in fact everyone is the loser. Everyone is the loser. Our spiritual power only arises when we know, or when we are willing to know and willing to learn and willing to practice and practice and practice our small and large acts of cooperation. Our small and large acts of enoughness. Our small and large acts of what the Buddhists again call sympathetic joy, which is a little bit of a stretch, actually. It's one of the Brahmaviharas, the perfections. Sympathetic joy is in a bit short supply, so I'm going to mention it early on. Sympathetic joy means being really pleased for somebody else, even if they've got what you wanted. It's really hard, I know. It is, it's hard. But in its difficulty, of course, it's also very productive. It's very productive because we can bring compassion also to ourselves around the difficulty that we're having with this. So it makes compassion for ourselves more meaningful. So rather than disdaining our absence of sympathetic joy, we bring compassion to it and we ask ourselves, all right, what is really needed? What am I not attending to? What am I not evoking in relation to my own life that I'm having these somewhat mixed feelings about someone else's success or joy or resolution or ease? Because in our heart of hearts, we also know that everyone also has their sorrows. And we also know in our heart of hearts that there is no external justice that we can make sense of. I don't think that we have an incredibly comfortable, privileged life by world standards simply due to our own merit. I don't think so. I think that we need to recognize that whatever sorrows are in our lives, and they're very real, we should have authentic compassion for them, at the same time generating from that compassion for those whose lives are as hard, harder, hardest. Those who are impoverished in soul or impoverished in body. Any one of us who is here to hear the living waters, who is somehow led to sit at the feet of these masters, and I mean masters in an inclusive gender way, any one of us who is able to pray and hold in our hearts an unconditionally loving knowledge of the divine force, the divine power. Any one of us who is so fortunate in this way surely has compassion to spare for those who are impoverished of spirit, as well as impoverished of body, and sometimes not impoverished of spirit at all. At the same time, we can take our own sorrows seriously enough that we bring compassion to them in order that we can learn from them. In other words, I'm not inviting you to say to yourself, I'm disentitled to my sorrows because I live in a clean house with clean water and I know where my children are safe. No, I'm not saying that for one moment, because each of our sorrows is very real to us. And each of our sorrows also teaches us that suffering is part of existence, which is the first of the noble truths. Suffering is indeed part of existence, but what suffering teaches us individually can only teach us individually, because for all our compassion, I can't feel your suffering, I can only feel with you. So suffering teaches us individually I will therefore be the cause of as little suffering as possible. It is the primary teaching on the spiritual path. It's also the primary teaching on the medical healing path. Do no harm. I will do no conscious harm. And where I do harm, inadvertently, unconsciously, I will make amends. I will own up to it. I will take responsibility for it. I will grow up through it. Yeah? That's what waking up is. That's what waking up is. Actually, I had an almost entirely wakeful night last night. I thought, heavens, have I become a literalist? I've become a literalist Buddhist. I'm not really a Buddhist and I'm not really a literalist, but I thought come awake was taken a bit too far last night. But anyway, that's what waking up is. Noticing what we're doing. Noticing its effects on the other. Noticing our power to influence for the better. Noticing our power to influence bleakly. It's also the first principle of moral and emotional intelligence, that we take responsibility, that we grow in self-awareness and we take responsibility for how we affect other people. It's so easy, isn't it, to be distracted by images of power that exists outside ourselves, particularly those images of power that would seek to diminish us. We have to step around them with a certain lightness of foot. But also we have to pay attention when they echo and re-echo and resound in our own minds. When they tell us that we are smaller, lonelier, less significant, less capable, less precious, less beautiful, less forgiving, less compassionate, less wise than we are. Claiming our spiritual qualities is a lifelong dance, poem, song, isn't it? Those of you who've been to many, many retreats, we have to keep returning, don't we? We can hear something, then we need to hear it again. We haven't heard it today, let us hear it again. Which is why the practice of prayer and of meditation is so, it's the jewel. It's the bringing to the heart, the heart. Here's a tiny little teaching from the Buddha. Actually, before I read it, I want to tell you that one of the teachings of Jesus that so explicitly reflects his Jewishness, his deep love for the Torah, his utter respect for the prophets who came before him. And that it is also so exquisite in its simplicity. And you will weep hearing it, because our entire world would be completely different if the church that was founded in his name had taken it the least bit seriously. But he said this, not just love one another, as I have loved you, which means, I believe, unconditionally, without division between the deserving and the undeserving, which means always looking round for anyone who might believe that they should be or have been put to the margins, always. So that's one thing. Love one another. Not if you're nice to me, not if I agree with you, if you're theologically adept. No. Love one another as I have loved you, with all my heart and with all my passion. And also even with my doubts and resistances, which we know Jesus also sometimes felt. But what I really want to say to you is, he also said this about his followers. Let my followers be known for the way in which they love one another. Wouldn't that make you weep? Wouldn't that make you weep? I don't think really we need to know anything more about compassion and wisdom. So what he's telling us there, and what comes through in all the mystical teachings, and you know, it's such a sorrow, I'll get to the Buddha, it's such a sorrow that mysticism has been associated and kind of feared as a kind of impractical withdrawal from the world, because in fact the quite opposite is true. All the mystical teachings bring us much more solidly into the world. They all stress conduct. They all move us into the conduct that is worthy of this precious existence. Yeah? One of the reasons that mysticism was feared for a very long time, at least within Christianity, and interestingly enough, within Islam, Sufism was protected much longer than mysticism was protected either in Judaism or Christianity. Buddhism also has its mystical form, Shingon in Japan, and Tibetan Buddhism, Mahayana. So within Christianity particularly, mysticism was also questioned and sometimes forbidden, because it also depends on direct revelation. In other words, the small quiet voice within counts for something. It's not necessarily the robed person in front of you. In fact, always question the robed person in front of you. Yeah. And also check the teachings against your own experience. Check the teachings against your own experience. Allow yourself to be inspired and then discover what works. What lifts your spirits? What lifts other people's spirits? Use the gospel of the face. Watch other people's faces. Read the face of whoever is in front of you. Yeah? Read the face. How are you affecting that other? So to the Buddha. When your mind is filled with love. Now, how would you fill your mind with love? Well, one of the ways is to notice your resistances and treat them gently. But let them know that they don't necessarily have to have the best seat in the house. Yeah? And just allow a moment or two through the day to be filled with love. So bringing love to consciousness, bringing yourself as an instrument of love to consciousness, allowing love to be your guide, your teacher, your mother. In the Buddhist tradition, of course, it is Kuan Yin who is the goddess of compassion. And in the Hebrew tradition and in the Christian tradition, it is Sophia who is wisdom. This does not mean that those qualities are meant for women only. On the contrary, they are intended for the receptive part of all of humanity. And you could say that it is the receiving part that is so blocked in so many people, regardless of gender. If they were receiving love, it would be very automatic to give it. So I want you to pay close attention to that during the course of these retreat days, that your giving is fruitful, but so is your receiving. That is a very necessary consciousness of self-compassion, that your receiving becomes refined and is not blocked. So back to the Buddha. When your mind is filled with love, send it in one direction. Then a second. Then a third. Then a fourth. Then above. Then below. Identify with everything. Without hatred, resentment, anger, or enmity. Then the Buddha says, the mind of love is very wide. It grows immeasurably and eventually is able to embrace the whole world. So we're going to take a few moments. You can just put your notebooks down, closing your eyes, and I'm just going to give you a small meditation on that. Feet flat on the floor. Bringing compassion first to any resistances that you might have. Bringing compassion to any self-doubt, any feelings of insufficiency. bringing compassion also to the wonder of this moment. And allowing an image of fullness to arise in your mind. Fullness of heart. Fullness of being. Fullness of divine love. You do not have to deserve fullness. It is your birthright. You do not have to fear emptiness, which gives way to, which surrenders to, which allows for fullness to reemerge. From this place of fullness, however you are experiencing it, we will send love first to the north. We will send love to the south. We will send love to the east. We will send love to the west. We will allow our hearts to open to all those who share our gift of life. Without exception. All want what you want. All fear what you fear. All were born and all will die from this body, from this life. sending love to all beings, known and unknown, admired and disdained. Those who are born and those who are yet to be born. Those entering this life and those leaving it. May they come awake to their capacity to love. May they and we hold each other in safety, in trust, in harmony, in goodwill and well-being. May we express love through all that we do. May our minds of love grow very wide, very deep, very high. May we grow to love the small, the subtle, the particular. May our love encircle the entire world. Blessed be.